Welcome to the Role Player Podcast on wolfamongwolves.com, also known as the Wolf Among Wolves Network, featuring a ton of great writers, ton of great podcasts. Go check all of them out at the website. Our particular podcast is brought to you by Blake Seed Based, which is a Chicago-based company making seed and fruit snack bars. They've already been featured in CNN, Forbes, Vogue, and Real Simple, and have been voted in Real Simple as the best fruit and snack bar. Super fire. It's a Chicago-based company founded by a Minnesotan, Blake Sorensen, who had a deathly nut allergy and was just looking for a way to create snacks that everyone can enjoy. The snacks use pumpkin, sunflower, and flax seeds, real fruit, and chocolate, and are crazy delicious. You can eat them if you're barefoot water skiing, saunas and cold tubs, couch surfing, breakdance battles, sitting at your desk, or anything in between. They got crazy good flavors. My personal favorite is the blueberry lemon, but they also got the pineapple, the s'mores, and the raspberry. So you got to go check out the variety pack if you want, or you can buy them individually. Whatever you want to do, I promise you'll thank me later. All you got to do is go to blakecbase.com and check out everything they have to offer. And if you're listening to our podcast, go use our promo code ROLE, R-O-L-E, to get 20% off. That's BlakeSeedBase.com, BlakeSeedBase.com, for those of y'all that can't spell, and go seed your passion with Blake Seed Base.
Goes to the rim, throws up a touch shot, got it, count it, and a foul. Jordan Taylor with a money move and one.
Welcome back to the Role Player Podcast after a brief hiatus. Housekeeping and all. We got to give our co-host Trevor Blackway a special shout out for his new gig at Eden Prairie as the assistant AD director, assistant AB.
So are you right down the street?
But nah, we got a very special guest with us today. OG to us, for real. Former first round pick, 25th overall to the Boston Celtics. Currently the VP of basketball development with the Timberwolves and the Lynx. And has been everywhere from Minneapolis to China and back. We got the one and only John Thomas. John, thanks for coming on. Appreciate you, man.
Jordan, absolutely my pleasure. And Trev, he must have been influenced you because you got that red on for that Wisconsin. I was going to say, man, I mean. Hey, man, I'm a big fan of both of you guys. I really appreciate all that you continue to do, not only within this community, but what you've meant for basketball in general. So, man, anytime, any place, anytime you guys ask, I appreciate
it. Man, no doubt. So, you know, we was talking before a little bit off air, just talking about how athletes have tremendous opportunity and don't necessarily utilize everything that they have available to them. Yeah, I think it's growing. I think they're figuring it out. I think people like yourself are helping them figure it out. Just kind of talk about your career. You know, obviously, Gopher legend, Minnesota legend. Talk about how you started at the U and how you've been everywhere to China, to Boston, to Korea, Israel. Talk about what you learned in your career and how you kind of figured out the matrix of basketball, not only the playing side, but the business side.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much time we have. I mean, I've learned a lot, but I think to really try to encapsulate and maybe to take you back to your request. I started playing basketball late. It took me some time, I think, as of late, to realize why I started playing basketball. I mean, my mother and father split, and then my mother cut the cord of the television when my brother and I were watching too much television. We figured out how to splice it. Then she cut it again, and we spliced it again. And she's like, all right, y'all too smart for this. So she got rid of the TV. So there were two big voids in our household. Dad was gone. And the television was gone. So I now realize as a 45-year-old man that I was trying to connect with my father. And that void that he left, you know, coupled with the stories that he would tell us and how I would pick up on how he used to run the parks and run the streets and super early in the morning and shoot baskets. And I just started doing that, and I became this park kid. And I used to go to Sabathany Community Center and sweep the gym floors in exchange for time. And I go to Phelps, and I go to the old Central Community Gym. And so that's really what formed, I think, and I like to say that basketball became my gang. Mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of my passion. And then from there, it just kind of took off, because the biggest thing is I was coachable, and I worked hard, and I kept my nose clean. I didn't do all the other things that other people were doing. And I also had this innate sense that I was late to the party, so I kind of needed to hurry up. So, you know, through that journey through high school, ended up choosing University of Minnesota. And it's nice to see Dave Thorson back in the mix. He was the one who recruited me. So I think they got a gem there. And then Ben Johnson, I mean, you guys know from being former players and playing on a lot of different teams, like, you want coaches that are relatable, know what they're doing, but at the end of the day, you know, they care about you, right? Because you're going to want to run through a wall for them. So that's what I had at University of Minnesota with Clem Haskins and Dave Thorson. And, you know, then at some point, I never thought I was going to be a pro. I mean, 4-year run with the University of Minnesota, encapsulated by a Final Four run as a senior. And then it was, son, you're going to be a pro. And I never thought that was going to happen. So I was actually drafted by New York Knicks. I was traded right away to the Celtics. And then I played a little bit with the Celtics. And then, ironically, Richard Pitino, Rick Pitino, when I saw Richard Pitino as a youngin' running around on the bus in the plane, acting a fool. I was traded twice within my first year. So I had a 5-year NBA career. And in between there, I kind of started a business and kind of fell out of love with the game, and really understood and started to understand that, you know, the true business of the sport. So I'll stop there, but I'll, you know, let you pick apart what you need to from there, and can dive into other parts of your questions as well.
I talk on that first year, you know, you get drafted, it's a high, you know. You drafted first round, you go into that experience. Now you trade twice. So, like, what was kind of like your thoughts that first year? And, like, yeah, what was your feelings throughout that period?
Great question, Trev. I wanted to feel the triumph or the defeat of getting drafted or not, because everything I was hearing was first round to not getting drafted at all, based upon the 18 teams that I worked out for. I had a really good showing at Portsmouth. I was on an all-star team in Phoenix, and I went to Chicago and just absolutely killed it. So, Bobby Jackson and I were sitting in the stands in Charlotte. He got his name called for 23rd pick. 24th pick came up. As they finished the 24th pick, they started bending the hat, started kind of looking towards me. I'm like, me? Like, yeah, you. So, I mean, that thing was such a blur, man. You get called up. I shook David Stern's hand. You kind of get sequestered. What's that?
How big was your suit?
How big was my suit? Yeah, man, yeah. There's pictures online. You can go check it out. It was whack, though. It was an olive old man suit. I think I want to say I still have it too. Somewhere. It wasn't that big. It was decent. I mean, it had the oversized tie though. I wasn't appreciating that, but yeah, man. But yeah, I got sequestered to the back. And it was just quick. But then to your point, Trev, like, I think the humanization of who we are gets lost in the business. You know, that's the hard part, that, you know, when you think about getting traded, just that word alone is a tough pill to swallow. I mean, the backdrop for me was, you know, high school basketball experience, collegiate basketball experience. And, you know, I'm a loyal person. So getting traded is actually an affront to my value system, because I truly thrive in building relationships with other people. So I hit the ground running, and I wasn't trying to stay home. I immersed myself immediately in New York. And actually, Tibbs was one of my workout guys, as was Brendan Malone. And I saw them all summer. So, you know, developing those relationships, and then just, you know, having Jeff Van Gundy come into my room and tell me that, can I turn the TV off? I'm like, sure, coach. He sits me down. He's like, you've been traded to the Boston Celtics. I'm like, what? And we were in Boston to play the Celtics. And so he was like, just stay here. someone's going to come pick you up. So you have no idea what's happening, what's going to happen, Matt. As soon as he left the room, I could pick up the phone, call my agent, and I was crying. Because I came in and Patrick Ewing was there, Charles Oakley, Larry Johnson, Buck Williams. I mean, true old school vets, man. I was like loving the experience. Yeah. And so I got moved. So that was tough, man.
The humanization, is that like a rejection type feeling? Cause I mean, even, I guess we feel it overseas too, but being traded, I mean, signing with the new team, you're always kind of like, all right, well, you know, fuck them. Like, I'll just go get more money here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But being traded. Talk about the dehumanization of it. Cause I mean, I don't even think that we can relate to it on that level. Outside of crying, obviously.
Yeah, man. I'm an emotional person when it comes to those kinds of things. I mean, it's particularly the matters of the heart, right? Like I feel, and it's, and I embrace it, right? It's just who I am. But you got 72 hours at least. You know, you got 72 hours to pack your stuff up and be in another city. You know, for me, that same night, I was sitting on the opposing bench, looking at the dudes that I just went through a tough training camp with, where Patrick Goon was like, come on, rookie with me. You know, LJ was the one who welcomed me into the facility, me not knowing anybody. And he sees me from across the hall and he's like, big fella. And he yells it in the doctor's office. Right. And it was just all out love.
Right.
And so to lose that in a moment's notice. And then when I saw them at the end of the game and they're like, man, I'm sorry. Right. I mean, I'm just like, then I was holding back my tears because I was, you know, you're going to cry in front of the fellas, man, but I felt like it. But, you know, people, I think the public doesn't understand the psychology and the mental strain that comes along with being traded, or even when the trading deadline is being approached, as to the mentality that's associated with the potential of your move. Because they think that, you know, hey, you've got this limelight, you've got this money, you've got access, you got all these things. And you know what? Coming into it before it happens to you, you're thinking the same thing. Like, hey, I'm about to come up with some money, whatever, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Once you have it, the thing you realize is the only thing you want is, first, you want safety, you want security, you want connection, you want empowerment, and you want to compete.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, with the best teams that you guys played on, right? That camaraderie, that competition, that there's nothing like it. So you're moving away a piece of chemistry that is, in a moment's notice, you're just pushed into another direction. And, you know, you got to learn all different faces, perfect strangers picking you up. You're like, man, I don't know you. You got to go get a physical. You don't know the team doctor. I mean, there's so many different components to that piece. And then it's like you're thrust into a new city. You don't know how to get around. You don't know all the different people. I mean, your life has literally been flipped upside down.
How was your transition to the Celtics?
As far as basketball is concerned, New York Knicks were playing a half court, you know, bang up style. It was how I played, right? Back in the day, Big Ten basketball. We're going to beat you up, right? And if you look at that roster that I just named, all those people play that way. So I was the perfect complement to that. And I had worked out so much during the summer, like I was starting to get some three-man skills. So that was the other part that I was excited about. So I'm like, hey, right? Just getting all that in my game. But then moving over to play in Rick Pitino's system, like he was pressing. He was the only coach in the NBA that was pressing. And to be on the front line, like in his system, like I had to be the one. As soon as they scored, like I'm the one who's shadowing the ball outside. And then the first pass in, I'm running over to shadow that. And then, by the way, now I got to go against somebody who's my size or bigger after I just exerted myself a few times trying to do that. I remember playing against the Bulls. That was our first nationally televised game against the 97-98 Bulls. First of all, I mean, I was completely out of my mind because I'm like, man, I was just playing Lakers versus Celtics with Mike and them. And next thing I know, like I'm blocking Mike's shot. I'm doing all this. I'm like, man. But anyway, I was so tired just from not only blocking Mike's shot, but just being purely nervous. Man, during a timeout, Coach Pitino sits down, calls Sean Brown. I think, did you have Sean Brown with you, Trev?
Yeah.
So he was with us. So he's like, Sean Brown called Sean Brown out the stands. It was like, I want 20 pounds off of John Thomas by tomorrow. So the experience, you know, was one that I just wasn't used to. I mean, I ran before practice. I had a tough 2.5 hour practice. I had me running after practice. So I was on the treadmill. He was trying to cut weight, but I'm like, man, even at my best, I'm 265, 260 pounds. You're not going to get much off me.
Right.
You know, so the styles were distinctly different.
What was the, back it up, what was the business you started? You said you fell out of love with the game. Did that have something to do with it? That getting traded, that style, I guess, not fitting in the style. And then I guess, what made you fall out of love with the game, and what was the business you started?
Great question. You know, oftentimes you find yourself in a situation where you're not able to have honest conversations around kind of your path, your trajectory, what's expected of you as a player. Because things are happening probably that are out of the coach's control to some degree, and you don't understand. The other side of it too was that I had an agent that wasn't the most, let's call it, connected, right? I was his only NBA client, and one of my former teammates, Michael Stewart, he was rep by Bill Duffy. So Yogi, it was, we call him, Michael Stewart called him Yogi. Yogi got a 6-year, $24 million deal. And I didn't, you know, coming from the Knicks to then Boston to now to Toronto, I didn't have, I was probably in a lot of ways scared to try to create connections. And I kind of was just this, I kind of stayed to myself. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand how to build relationships because I'm like, I'm about to get moved again. Right. It's almost like you get PTSD to some degree.
Right.
You said agent kept you in some good cities.
Yeah, well, I think it was circumstantial. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, just kind of happened to be a part of it. And but I think I fell out of love with it because I didn't understand the business. I didn't understand how to build relationships with my coaches. I didn't understand how to ask the right questions. You know, traditionally, when you think about any organization that's a sports organization, there's two sides of the house. There's business operations and there's basketball operations. Basketball operations, what everybody sees. It's the president of basketball operations, the general manager, the coach, and every other member of the front office that helps those players, inclusive of strength coaches and you know, the athletic trainer and everyone else that's dedicated. So when you think about it, again, it's two sides of the house. So those two sides of the house have, you know, their own parts in driving against what we know to be, you know, the actual franchise or the team. And from a basketball perspective, I didn't understand that first I was playing in fear when I should have been playing in opportunity. Right. And every moment that I received, whether it was 1 minute, no minute, like every way, which way in which you can contribute, you're on a stage and you're one of 15 people. So how you act, how you connect, how you build relationships is your opportunity when the spotlight is on. So I didn't understand that. And I also got angry at the fact that I was playing more minutes than he was, or I was starting. I went on like a 12-game starting spree when Kevin Willis got hurt and we were hooping. And I looked at that as justification that I should have gotten more money. But, you know, never mind another person's backyard. Only take care of your business. And I kind of just stopped caring. So go ahead.
At what point did you figure all that out? What'd you say?
It didn't take me until a long time. You know, it probably, in a lot of ways, it wasn't until I had retired. Because when you're playing, you're chasing, right? And you're chasing contract after contract, and you get into this routine, and it's like, hey, I got to make sure I work out in the offseason. And then the offseason comes, and if you're in the league, it's a whole different animal than it is when you're playing overseas, because overseas is – you're going to an entirely new country for about 8 to 9 months where they're going to destroy your body. And it's completely different. Right. And they're going to destroy your body and your mind. Right.
How much I miss basketball. Like, I do not miss waking up. And, can't move.
Yeah, man. People don't understand how bad your body hurts, right? And then what you have to go through. Yeah.
I don't even ask Jordan his stats. I'll be like, yo, how's your hips? How's your back?
Yeah. So it took me a while to figure it out, Jay. And then I started the business because at that point, so it was a contextual advertising platform. So think of it as what you see on Instagram right now. And you know how you see those still images? And if you see like that little dot that you like, what's that dot? And you go to click on it and it'll show you like some shoes or whatever. Yeah. Well, my ex-wife and I have a patent for that.
Oh, dope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a whole nother podcast and a whole nother story on the disillusion of that marriage and, you know, what that meant for a hard life lesson that I had to learn. But all things considered, I mean, it kind of set the stage for, you know, how I see opportunity and ultimately business is just truly about, you know, figuring out what problems are, you know, you can solve and how you're most qualified to do so.
Did you said you were playing catch up. This is kind of unrelated. I was actually thinking about this the other day. You know, in basketball, you're in an environment where, you know, 30-year-olds, 25-year-olds are getting paid a lot of money. And do you ever feel like you were behind or like inadequate stacking yourselves up to, I guess, because those dudes are probably even beyond the 1% at that age, even compared to dudes like Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett didn't make most of his money till after 35, 40 or whatever, right? So did you ever lose confidence or feel inadequate, like looking at a dude like Michael Stewart, being like, damn, he got $24 million, like what I got? You
know what I'm saying? I got 2.1 in my contract. My last year is about to be done.
Yeah, and be like, damn, I'm broke. Like, I ain't getting nothing. You know what I'm saying? Did you ever have that ever affect your mindset?
You know what? Not really. I mean, it was that instance specifically when, you know, and back then that was a bag. I mean, it was like 6 years, 24, like that for a backup center, like you're getting it. Right. And it's longevity, right? I mean, you got 6 years and after taxes, you're going to clear still a nice chunk of change. But I played with KG and I you know, you run into him and you pull out your little gold Amex and he's got the black Amex. That's when I was like, okay, I really don't have any money or status or whatever. But I didn't get too caught up on that. I think, you know, just my personality was one that I wanted to be a great teammate. You know, I wanted to provide the best that I could. I don't think I recognized my potential. You know, in a lot of ways, I was conflict averse when it came to, you know, having tough conversations. You know, my way of managing conflict was, you're in my spot, I'm about to move you, right? You can't do that all the time, you know, from a physical standpoint. So it's been something that I've had to learn throughout the course of my time as I've retired.
So having all that knowledge and you've had all the experience and gained this perspective, talk about how you used that and leveraged it into what you've done to leverage that into your, you know, your current position with Timberwolves and the Lynx and just kind of your brand. I mean, you're obviously a name across Minnesota and you're at, you know, I see you at FEMA's, you know, you at the, everybody who want to be around AT, you at the events, you at the galas. So talk about how you leveraged all that and kind of taking that knowledge utilized it in your life after basketball.
Well, first of all, shout out to FEMA. Right.
Shout out to FEMA. Advertising partner on the show, man.
Right, no doubt, right? Hey, look him up for a sponsor. It's my transition away from the game was really a scary place for me. Even though I had started the business, in a lot of ways, I was more of the visionary and conceptual thinker when it came to sort of the product ideation. But in terms of the nuts and bolts and the strategy and how to put the business together and what that meant for, you know, a rollout or the true essence of the P&L, the bottom line of the business, I had no concept of. So when I moved over, I was like, I don't have any discernible skills.
Can you give us some more cheese when you're done making? When he's done, call.
You want me to make you some grilled cheese and without the call?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, man.
I'll take one too.
You want grilled cheese? You want a grilled cheese too? You want, hey, JT, you want a grilled cheese too?
Man, I got a shooter around. I don't need no grill. Tell him I said thanks though.
I appreciate it. But it was I had no real concept of business terms, really recognizing what that all meant, you know, but I used my fear and my drive that when, you know, I'm walking into a meeting at Lifetime and from one of my first days and they're talking about, you know, what are your financial projections and your contribution margin of the business? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll have that ready for tomorrow's meeting. And I literally would go in with my badge at like 4:30 in the morning and look up all the terms and just, and I did that for months and just teaching myself. And then after that, then it was like, I'd find all these different videos of key business leaders. And I'd look at how they were positioning what they were saying, like a Gary Vee or Seth Godin or, you know, whether it was business or it was life or all these different virtual mentors, if you will, like they were mentoring me. They didn't even know it. So I started to take in all those lessons and applying it to my daily life. But then the thing is, I wanted to empower all the people. So I went from being a national coordinator to a national manager and then moving up. And that was really how I sort of cut my teeth early on. And then had the opportunity after about 4.5 years of Lifetime, just by, you know, getting introduced to Ethan Cashin, our CEO, you know, they basically created a position for me. And the thing that I understand is that, you know, first you have to be a good listener. After being a good listener, the question is, are you curious? And then are you willing to do the little things? No different than within basketball. Like whenever we do suicides, I made sure that I touched every line. But then even on our squad, I want to make sure that all of our players touched every line. Right. Because it's like I'm holding myself accountable. I'm going to make sure that I can hold. So it was all those transferable skills. Right? If I saw garbage in the locker room, I was like, hey, man, come on, pick that up. Right. All these little things that, you know, sort of championship minded teams do because they care about each other. They have pride. I just transferred all those skills. And it was like, OK, what is this business trying to solve? What does the department ultimately look like? What's my role specific within the job description and how can I first meet expectations, but then exceed them? But then looking for, like I do in basketball, that's the thing about sport, which I love, which it's the ultimate truth, right? It's binary. As soon as that ball leaves our hand, it's 100% of the time, it's going to go in 50%, right? So yes or no, it's going to go in every single time. So it's true. So that feedback for me was my oxygen. So it's just, how would I get that feedback? You know, how am I paying attention to body language? If I said something, you know, how are my leaders looking at me? What are some of the other ones that they're like, you know, he's doing a great job. She's doing a great job. What did I pay attention to? All those nuances that I took from the game, I started applying to business. And, you know, it's gotten me here. And again, I'm still learning. You know, there's right. So much more around executive presence that I look at some of the key CEOs around this, around not only our company, but our community across the world. Like I'm a constant curious learner and it's fueling me.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of, you know, and so from that, then it's just like, how do you extend your network? And you know, you say I'm all at these galas and I'm all at these things. It's, you start to realize in a lot of ways, you know, John Thomas Inc. and what is it that he has that lines up with my organization or, you know, individually, how do we share the same type of values and what does that look like for us and how we help each other build? That's, you know, that's how I look at it.
So I want to talk to your first job after playing basketball, you know, you retire, just like that humbling experience going from making, you know, six figures, being a man to now you're, you know, you did the Ultimate Hoops, something you talked about. I love the story. You know, we used to meet always in the summers because I always kind of thought about life after basketball myself. What does it look like? And I remember that, you know, you're telling that humbling experience, you know, when you get that first check and what that looks like.
Yeah, man. At my peak, I was making $33,000 net from my $2.1 million contract that I had as my rookie. So at my peak, I was 33 net every 2 weeks. So that's 66 total. That's at my peak. At my lowest, my first job was $24,000 a year or $577.46. And I had no contract negotiation skills because all my agent had negotiated my contract. I had no conflict resolution skills. I mentioned, right? Like, you're in my spot, get out, right? But how do I resolve that? When an offer is presented, how do I even combat it without being combative? You know, it'd be like, hey, but at the same time, I've got no relevant experience, right? Hey, I can't come in here and be like, hey, by the way, I can hoop, right? Well, that's not what we're hiring you for. Right. So it really taught me a lot about value and what I thought in my head, just because, you know, you think Lifetime's a multi-billion dollar corporation and I deserve $100,000, right? That's in my mind, people in my market, my people around me. Yeah, that's right. You deserve it. Like, I'm like, I know way more basketball than everybody does in this entire organization. And you walk in that meeting and you chest all puffed out. Like, as soon as you walk out, like, no, you don't. So it was it was a super humbling experience, and I'm grateful for the opportunity that allowed me to see, certainly what market value means. And if you don't like the market value, or at least for what's been positioned to you, you have a choice. You can choose to accept it and be angry, or you can choose to accept it and say, I'm going to change it. Or you can choose to deny it. But at the time, I didn't have anything else. And I had cultivated a relationship with a few people at Lifetime, most notably Bram Crotty, the CEO. And it was one of those things where it was basically a startup, right? I mean, within Ultimate Hoops, in that P&L, they had never run a training business before. I was coming in basically as, you know, employee number one, trying to prove out this model. Now, do I think I deserve more than $24,000? I mean, sure. But I'm thankful for the lesson, because I screenshotted that $577.46, and I'll never forget the number, because it motivates me.
Did it make sense for them? You said it was a startup. Did it make sense? $24,000, even if you were worth it. Like, was it like, all right, we could take this dude and pay him the 50 he's worth, or we're paying someone $24,000 because that's what we can afford?
Nah, they could have paid me more. they could have paid me more. I could have made more money than that at a number of jobs.
Right. Well, I was like,
I think, ironically, it was a litmus test, right? I'm an unproven commodity that was coming in that, you know, certainly had some brand recognition, and you know, you can argue there's value in that, but at the end of the day, you got to be able to run a business and put together and do your job. And so that starting block for me, and that's the thing that I think is really hard when it comes to being a former athlete. We create this myopic focus within one area, coupled with that dopamine hit that we all think because we're making buckets and everybody's like, yay. And then we think we're special because we're not doing the thing that, you know, at some point is coming anyway. Like, you're about to be done. You don't even know when it is. So you keep check chasing and you keep opportunity chasing. At some point when you hit 30, and particularly if you're overseas, all those agents overseas, they're smoking cigarettes that, well, you know, you are 30 years old now. So, you know, the deals aren't going to come the way they need to come. You're like, man, come on, man. I can still hoop. Right. But
like what you tell them,
your market is telling. What was that, Trev?
For 30 in Europe, you like 60 year olds in their eyes.
Right. So, yeah.
You mentioned a lot of stuff you talk about. You mentioned how you grinded and kind of your sense of accountability in yourself is one thing that sticks out to me. So I guess I want to relate that to the player, this kind of player empowerment movement. And do you think that accountability gets lost with some of these younger guys in the player empowerment movement, or not so much?
Well, help highlight with the player accountability movement. What specifically are you pointing to?
So I wanted to, well, one, I guess being able to use brand recognition and kind of use it to transcend above the team, and also on a college level, just the transfer rule, as broadly speaking, like being able to pick and choose where you want to go and just up and leave whenever you want. Is it that's player empowerment now? I don't know how. you know, if that should be considered player empowerment, but you know, it is.
I guess I look at it as, you know, good for the players, you know, good for the players for recognizing that it takes a lot of sacrifice and dedication to put themselves in a position that they do receive the attention. So if the attention that I'm receiving creates a certain dollar value, then what does that look like for me as the player? There's I think there needs to be, you know, certainly some education. I think that's what's happening. But, you know, even the approach to conducting business and what is the holistic trade-off or the mutual trade-off, if you will, between both parties. I certainly think that players can do a lot more, you know, when it comes to positioning themselves strategically for empowering themselves, which I think ultimately adds to the bottom line of the organization or the team. Because if I know how to connect with you, and I guess I look through two verticals, right? It's performance and engagement. The first part is like, I have to be able to perform in order for me to even get your attention. But the second part of it is like, am I engaging enough to command your attention for longer periods of time? And the litmus test that I look through, particularly when it comes to players, is the first one is I just put my player hat on and say, do I want to hoop with you? Because if I don't want to hoop with you, the second part of my narrative is like, would I pay to see you play? Because if I don't want to hoop with you, then I'm not going to come to see you play. But, you know, who are those dogs, right? And who are those that like compete? So you got to be able to perform. And then the other part is the engagement piece. So I think, you know, relative to the engagement, it's on court, off court. And we're seeing a lot of it sort of rear its head around social media and just the ability to command attention based upon my crazy crossover and jelly roll that I hit you with at the rim. Right. And so people and organizations have monetized it for so long where the player hasn't had any idea as to what the value proposition is. And so players are getting smarter around it. I just think that you just have to be, you're getting smart, but you have to be really smart. You have to be intentional about my in-season strategy, my off-season strategy, like who's involved, who are the key stakeholders, who's making decisions.
Does that take away from performance, you think?
It doesn't have to.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to. I mean, let's look at WWE, right? I mean, they came out and said, we're literally changing from WWF to WWE. And I'm not saying that, you know, players today, you know, need to go out and jump off the top ropes to get people's attention. But, you know, the thing that I am saying is that, you know, we live in a social media digital age. And I mentioned like at a moment's notice, right? We can all pick up our phones and be entertained for free. So the fracture of attention continues, right? And we're in a microwave society. And so it's like, if we don't like the old model, I believe for players is like, nah, you gotta actually love your fans. You gotta know the difference between fan and season ticket member. That's an investor.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. You got to know the difference between a corporate partner, right? A community organization, all the different ways that an organization makes money. Right. I mean, that's the way in which, you know, you can figure out, you know, what's my part within the rules. And just because if, as an example, the rules say that you can't, it doesn't mean that you can't engage. Right. How do you build equity into something? And so you can, I think to your question, you know, does it take away from performance? Nah, it doesn't have to, right? If I see someone if I know is a CEO of a major corporation sitting in the first row, and I know that we share to some degree some level of same values, I'm going to go create a micro deposit with that person just because they're bringing a client, a significant other, or a child to the game. And remember, they have the disposable income to sit anywhere they want, but they chose to sit on the first row. Why? Because they want to be seen. So right. Go see them.
Right.
Develop that relationship because you have something they don't, and they have something you don't. So if you're trying to build a path for ascension that doesn't end up like the story that I did where I had to start from zero, you got to build while the lights are on. Because once those lights go off, those cameras go down, and you don't control those cameras. So, you know, how do you control your own narrative?
Right.
Exactly.
Well, that's where I gotta leave it there, Trev. You can because I gotta run to.
Unbelievable, JT.
Yeah.
see how these Badgers do us, Trev. Hey,
you cut us off. Nah, but appreciate you, John. You know how much you mean to me. You've been a great mentor for myself, big brother. I look at you. Sorry, Jordan's disrespectful. But appreciate you being on the show with us.
Of course, my man. Anytime.
All right.
Yep.